You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Open source, grassroots, community, radio, solar powered, right here broadcasting from the Cultural District in our almost sunny little town. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my guest host, or not guest host, co-host.
Co-host, yeah.
And
one, well, it seems
mother,
like guest host lately.
Caroline Kilborn. Yeah, welcome back, Mom. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, it's trying to be warmer today, and that's good. I'm not ready for winter, not ready.
Yeah, well, I don't know if anybody is ever ready for an Iowa winter.
True.
And our guest today doesn't have to think about that.
No. And it's got to be a first.
Well, yes. Why don't you tell our listeners where our guest is calling from?
Well, our guest is calling from Bogota, Colombia, and he is the author, and he is Ronald Ringsrud, and he is... He wrote this book, this fabulous book, Emeralds, A Passionate Guide, The Emeralds, The People, Their Secrets. It's like nothing I've ever read before. It's just fantastic. It really is.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Ronald. Ron, are you with us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, well, welcome to Writers' Voices. We're on the air.
Thank you for the invitation.
So what's it like there in Bogota?
I'm on the 12th floor of the Emerald Trade Center in downtown Bogota, and Bogota is a city of 4 or 5 million people. It's like any big metropolitan city with a lot of public transportation, and there are about 7 buildings in downtown Bogota that are dedicated entirely to the emerald cutting, emerald dealing, and emerald exporting.
Wow.
So it's a clear day. It rained a little bit this morning, but that's typical, and it'll be clear for till the evening. It might rain tonight, but we are at 9,000 feet, so the temperature is not like you would expect of a city on the close to the equator. The temperature is actually kind of cool, like San Francisco would be. You can go out with a coat and tie on, and you're perfectly fine. You're not too hot.
Wow. So, Emeralds, A Passionate Guide. The Emeralds, the People, Their Secrets. When did you publish this book, Ron?
I just published it in July 2009, so
wow,
a year and a half ago.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this book and your story about how you became so passionate about emeralds.
Well, the book... it's the result of 20 years of being in the emerald business, and my original impulse to become an emerald dealer was when I got a job in Santa Monica, California, at the Gemological Institute of America, and it was just a regular job, but the first thing I learned at the institute was that the best emeralds in the world come from Colombia. The geologic conditions that give rise to emeralds in the Andes Mountains here are unique, and they produce a larger and finer color emerald in all the world. And I thought to myself, well, I've already been to Colombia. In the late 70s, I was teaching transcendental meditation in that country, in Manizales and Medellin, Colombia. So I had no culture barrier, no language barrier. And I thought to myself, well, this is interesting. And another year or two later, when I became a gemologist, I thought, well, I'll just specialize in emeralds. And that was a long time ago, and I'm kind of thick-headed, and I didn't change courses even when things went bad, but I've been an independent Colombian emerald dealer for over 20 years. And I never branched out into Brazilian or African emeralds or rubies or sapphires. Of course, I've sold a little of everything, including diamonds, but... I gained my living from selling just Colombian emeralds. So the impulse came from so many years of selling emeralds and coming up against people's misconceptions about emeralds that I thought I'd tell the whole story of emeralds. And I could start started with a blank computer screen and started writing, but by the time I told the whole story of Colombian emeralds and emeralds in general, the book ended up 23 chapters.
Yes.
When you started out, you didn't realize how much material you actually had?
It's true. I didn't realize how long it would take to tell the story. And there is a lot of material. In fact, when I got up to 300 pages, I had to... And this is true. I'm really a concise person. I love words, and I try to use them very well. But I got up to 300 pages, and I thought, well, this is going to go on and on. So I tried to make it as concise as possible, but still... I worked with a professional editor and a professional page layout artist, and the editor helped me a lot, and he knew some gemology as well, having worked for the GIA, that's Stuart Overland. And together we said we're going to keep it under 400 pages, and it ended up 384 pages.
Of course, you have a lot of illustrations. I mean, gorgeous
yes,
illustrations.
There are 250 photos or drawings or illustrations mm-hmm. in the book. And on top of that, there are 70 photos taken through a microscope looking mm-hmm. at the inside of emeralds.
Wow. It's fascinating. It really is.
Plus, the text is laid out. It's not dense. You know, you have a lot of white space, a lot of room. So it makes it easy to read.
Yeah.
Yes. Monica, it ended up a luxury book. My original idea was to create something that could sell for $24.
Didn't happen, did it?
Well, you know, gems are a luxury item, and you don't want to go cheap when you tell their story. So I even paid $4,000 extra just to use the best paper I could use, which is from a sustainable forest in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the book sells retail for $80, and it's been out for about a year and a half now, and it really is a luxury book. It's something that you can own for year after year and really enjoy it.
Well, the paper, the illustrations, everything goes together to make it a luxury book.
Well, it's a beautiful book.
It is.
Yeah, a beautiful
yes.
book, a beautiful subject. Ron, how long did you spend... when did you start writing? How long did it take?
It took 2 years to write.
Okay.
In fact, it was almost exactly 2 years. I started in 2007 and finished in early 2009. And the printing took just a few months. And I was looking at printers in Singapore, in China, in... There's excellent printers in Colombia as well, but I ended up having it printed in Marceline, Missouri.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So you self-published this book, is that?
Yes, I did. I self-published.
Which, in fact, to be honest, I didn't know that until you just told me, because most self-published books you can tell by looking at them that they're self-published, and that is not the case here.
No, at not all. At all.
It definitely looks like something that came from a very experienced press.
Yes, like I say, I worked with very good professionals, like Stuart Overland. The lady that did the page layout, you might notice the page layout and the choice of font and colors is very nice. It's beautiful. The page layout artist is Christina Carbonella of Bogota, Colombia. Mm. And I've known her husband for years. He's an editor. And I found out that she lays out pages. Originally, I was going to do the page layout myself and learn how to use Adobe InDesign, but I took a few hours looking at that, and it was kind of daunting, and I knew I could never do it properly or well, so I was really happy to find a professional that could lay out the pages for me.
Now, the photographs, are they all yours?
The photographs are all mine. They represent about 20 years of experience in the emerald business and going to the emerald mines, looking at stones through a microscope, looking at taking pictures of stones in good light, And there are a few photographs that I did have to purchase from the Smithsonian Institute or from the collection of the Queen of England, photographs like of the Hooker Emerald or of the Cambridge Emeralds from the Queen of England. But all of the other photos are mine.
Well, I have to congratulate you on a job well done with this book, and I would recommend it as, you know, if you're looking for a Christmas gift.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
Somebody who is hard, maybe a little hard to please, but would appreciate a passionate guide to emeralds. So, Ron, let's get a little bit into this, the history of emeralds, which you deal with quite extensively in the book. How did emeralds come to be so valuable?
Emeralds in the world have been valued very highly and revered, starting with Queen Cleopatra's mines in Egypt. And that mine has been depleted. It's completely devoid of emeralds now. But back in those times, that was the source of most of the emeralds in the world. There was a mine in what is now Austria that still continues to produce very small quantities of emeralds. And there was a mine, they're probably mining a little bit in what is now Pakistan, because the traders on the Silk Road would sometimes show up with emeralds from a different source. And what happened was that as the Spanish Empire expanded and the Spaniards conquered the New World, starting with Mexico and South America, they discovered in the hands of Indians that they were conquering and on their bodies these beautiful emeralds along with gold. And of course, the Spaniards love gold. They also know that emeralds are very valuable, and they found pearls in the Caribbean Ocean near what is now Venezuela. So they bought these gems and sold back to the new, back to the old world, to Spain, and they very quickly traded the pearls and gems with the Persians and the Portuguese. The Spaniards just wanted gold and more gold. And the Portuguese were the ones that took the emeralds to Persia. So as early as 1550, there were Colombian emeralds in the hands of the Persian traders, and that's how these emeralds got into the hands of the Mughal dynasty emperors like Akbar the Great and Janir Shah. So there used to be a common understanding that there was some hidden or unknown source of emeralds way far in the east, like in Asia, perhaps India, perhaps Rajasthan. And they called those old mine emeralds. But modern gemological analysis of those emeralds proves that those emeralds are emeralds from what is now Colombia. And Colombia has, for the past 500 years, been the source, been the only source of the finest and largest emeralds in the world.
Wow. Yeah, that's such a surprise that they would have made it so far around the world at that time. You know,
it's remarkable how world trade moves. And some of the emeralds even went not to Spain, but they traveled on Spanish treasure ships to the Philippines. And from the Philippines, they were traded, and the emeralds got to Asia from the east rather than from the west.
Oh,
so that might have added to some of the mystery of what is the origin of these fabulous emeralds.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Ron Ringsrud, author of Emeralds, A Passionate Guide, The Emeralds, The People, Their Secrets. And Ron is calling us from the heart of the Emerald Empire in Bogota, Colombia. So are there quite a few different mines in Colombia, or are there just one or two really big ones, or how does that whole aspect work?
Well, Monica, can I tell you what I did Friday?
Sure.
it's so interesting about the Emerald Mine. There was a client that wanted to see the Emerald Mine, and he, like many wealthy people, he was in a hurry, only had a day for Bogota and a day for the Emerald Mine, so he came in Friday, and we arranged for Saturday morning a helicopter ride out to the Emerald Mines. But his plane was late, and everything got pushed a little bit, but the thing about the Andes Mountains is that while Bogota is 9,000 feet altitude, and the Emeralds are down at 3,000 feet altitude, to get to those mines, there's about five Emerald mines, you have to go over some mountain peaks that are about 12,000 feet, which is kind of getting up to the upper limits of what a helicopter can do. Mm. And in fact, it was so intense that I thought to myself that a great sentence, a great first sentence of an adventure book would be something like this. To a helicopter pilot, it must be nerve-wracking to be on a small heliport high in the Andes Mountains, watching dark clouds approach and form and get closer to you while your clients are still deep in the Emerald Tunnels. Mm. How's that for a first sentence for an adventure book?
Well, it sounds like you've got your next writing project already planned out here.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what happened. We got, just to get from Bogota to the Emerald Mines, we had to dodge large clouds, and helicopters just don't do well without visibility. In fact, I noticed in the newspaper on Sunday a helicopter somewhere else in the Andes Mountains closer to Cali, Colombia, they did crash.
Ooh.
And the pilot that was piloting our helicopter was an ex-Colombian Army soldier. He was counter-guerrilla. He had been shot out of the sky once, so he's a man of great experience, and he's quite bold. But it was something to see, to watch him maneuvering, avoiding these black clouds, going through gaps in the clouds, and finding our way to the Emerald Mine. And then after several hours at the Emerald Mine, he was very nervous getting us back to Bogota. In fact, he said, we might have to, we're going to take off right now, but we might have to land back at the mine and spend the night here at the mine. These clouds are forming and they're closing us in. And then once we got up in the air, he said, well, we might have to land in this town called Villeta and take a taxi to Colombia, which is to Bogota, which is an hour and a half away. But amazingly, when we got close to the town of Villeta, a little sort of tunnel opened in these white clouds, and through the tunnel we could see blue sky. and he went for it, so he went right through the tunnel, and we made it back to Bogota, and my client was happy, and everybody was satisfied. Of course, the reason people go out to the Emerald Mines is because it is kind of an adventure, and they got to see the local people and enjoy the local climate at 3,000 feet altitude close to the equator. It's actually the most perfect climate you can imagine. It's not heavy tropical heat. It's just nice and balmy. And at 3,000 feet, you are above the area where there would be malaria mosquitoes. So you can spend the night there without worrying. And the food is great. But we had a miner's lunch, which consisted of rooster, rice, and yuca, and some potatoes.
Wait, did you say rooster?
Yes, rooster. it's kind of, and these are wild animals, free-range animals. It's every table where you eat at out there has toothpicks, so you can pick the meat out of your teeth after you're done eating, because it's kind of strange.
Now, is there any way to get to the Emerald Mines other than by helicopter?
Oh, yes. It's about 35 minutes by helicopter and 8 hours by road and four-wheel drive vehicle.
Wow.
But I assume that the miners live close by.
Yes, the miners are very simple people living a simple life, and some of them get rich quick if they find a big emerald crystal. There's always someone they know that has a big white Toyota four-wheel drive vehicle that he bought it because he found one emerald that he sold for millions of pesos.
So the miners that get to keep the emeralds they find?
The way that it works, Cuenca is that at the Emerald Mine, it's a great honor to be asked to work in the mine itself. So that means you're either a good friend or a good worker or a cousin of the mine owner. And rather than pay these people, they get room and board, and they get to keep and sell some of the emeralds that they find. Of course, the major veins of emeralds do get pulled out and put into leather bags, and those bags go to the owners. But there's always extra emeralds that come out, and it's just part of the culture of emerald mining down there.
So you talk about the issue of fair trade, and I know that many people are concerned, for example, the diamond mines, that people are being abused and the miners aren't being fairly compensated. Is that not so much an issue with emeralds?
Well, fair trade is a big issue in Colombia. The emerald miners were very quick to catch on to this idea of conflict diamonds and the problems they were having in Africa. And the thing with Colombia is that it's pretty easy to respect the environment because the emeralds are found in shale and the local rivers run in shale. So if you dump some shale into the rivers, it's not that big a deal. But they do catch some sediments in some ponds before they dump the water into the river. And another thing is that there's not much overpopulation in the region. In fact, it's a very remote mining region. So there's not a high poverty that you find. The land is very abundant. Nobody's hungry. Nobody's starving. There's just regular poverty where there's lack of education or lack of hospitals or clinics. And in the past 10 years, the emerald mining organizations here in Colombia have created clinics and expanded the size of hospitals that already existed out there. They've arranged for buses to carry the children of the miners to school, and they've supported the schools. So there's been a lot of respect and benefit towards the workers themselves that has been happening in the past 10 years here in Colombia.
So if you're someone here in the United States who would like a beautiful piece of jewelry but wants to feel good about what they're buying, maybe an emerald is the way to go.
Yes, Monica, some people ask the question, are the dollars that I'm spending, are any of those dollars going into the pockets of gorillas or narco gorillas, any drug mafias or anything like that? And we're always quick to say that it's absolutely not, because the region that the emerald mines are in are free from paramilitary or guerrilla activity. And in fact, in the late 1980s, there was sort of a small war fought to eject from the region a group of Medellin cocaine cartel people that tried to take over the emerald mines, namely Gacho Rodriguez, the partner of Pablo Escobar. And that little war lasted for about 4 years, and it resulted in the tracking down and killing of Pablo Escobar and Gacho Rodriguez. Since that happened, a peace was signed in the region that was looked over by the Archbishop of Chiquinquirá, a religious city in the state of Boyacá, and ever since then, that peace has been maintained, and it's been 17 years now. And they're very proud of it, because many peace accords in the world have been signed and they last about a year and then people are back at war. But twice a year these groups meet, the federal government, miners, the other interested groups, and they work out their problems.
Wow.
There has been a peace.
That's amazing. It really is. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I think the assumption would be that because, you know, emeralds are so valuable, that of course the drug cartels would control the emerald mines, and it's really reassuring to know that that's not the case.
Yeah, they were enemies 20 years ago, and they're still not very welcome in that region.
So, Ron, tell us a little bit about how the emerald trading or brokerage business works in Colombia.
In Colombia, the emeralds come from the mine and get cut in downtown Bogota. And this is similar to the way rubies get traded in Thailand or Burma or many other source countries, like the topaz from Brazil or any other gemstone. In the market, the owners really don't sell the stone. There's usually brokers that run from office to office carrying the gems that belong to the owners. And these brokers they really earn their money. They work on the owner to get him to go down to a reasonable price, and they work on the buyers to get them to come up to a good offer. And in some countries, the broker earns just a straight 10% commission, but in Colombia and other countries, the brokers earn whatever they can get, and the difference between the asking price of the owner and the buying price of the buyer. So we, as emerald buyers, we sit in offices and we look at parcel after parcel, and we'll make an offer on certain stones that we like, and we'll if the offer is pretty good, pretty close to what they want, they'll seal it with tape, write down the amount of money offered, and then the broker will go and talk to the owner and try to make the deal complete. And if they do complete the deal, they'll come back and the money will be arranged. It will usually be, if it's a professional buyer, the money will be paid in 20 days. And usually it's done by bank transfer. There's no need to pay cash if you're a professional regularly coming to the source country.
Now, what about someone who just, could someone just go and buy emeralds on their own? Like for a first time, how would you do that?
First timers could come and buy with cash. They could find people down on the streets selling emeralds. And of course, you'd have to speak Spanish, and you'd have to be good at separating the good people from the bad people. In fact, there's an underlying theme in my entire book that starts in the introduction and goes through the buying chapter as well. And the theme is just very simple. A lot of gemological books try to teach you every last bit of gemology so that you can go out and buy emeralds alone and check if they're synthetic or check for what inclusions they might have, check the price, and do everything by yourself. But in my book, I try to offer the idea that if you can just go out and find a few people that you trust, and those people really know how to select emeralds or gems, then you've just skipped a lot of steps and saved yourself from a lot of work trying to do it all yourself. You know, and in our world, we end up doing too much ourselves anyhow. We pump our own gas now. We make our own plane reservations. We scoop our own rice at the market. But if you have some people skills, you can find the right people to sell you your stones. And if you trust that person's usually going to reciprocate with a lot of hard work to make sure you're happy with your gem. So anyone that's new to the business should just spend some time talking to the local appraisers in your own country or talking to the locals in the country that you go to. And just use your people skills to find some trustworthy dealers. And try not to be too greedy, because it's usually the bad dealers that prey on people trying to save money or be greedy about buying gems.
So, and Ron, one of the advantages of reading your book is that you do teach a novice the language and the terminology so that they can go to these people and not look like idiots.
You have to know the lingo.
Yeah.
Chapter 4 is all about optics, and chapter 5 is about color, and it starts from the most basic information, and it includes the color schemes and wheels from GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, and it goes to specific examples of stones. There is a lot of information, concise, that is useful for someone that wants to learn a lot about stones without having to take a whole course in gemology.
And one thing I found that interesting, like a very basic thing to know, is that when you're going to buy a stone and you're given a price, it's not the price for the stone. It's the price per carat. And there's...
Someone does $2,000, he's usually talking about the price per carat of that stone. So if it's a 4-carat stone, the price for the whole stone is $8,000.
Do you have any tales where that... where someone's been gotten confused about that?
Yeah, there's a great story about Mr. Romero, who on his very first trip to Hong Kong, he had an emerald that he purchased in the rough. And when you buy an emerald in the rough, the price that is spoken really is the price for the whole piece. It's not per carat. So he bought it in the rough for about $800. And then he faceted it. He put about 80 little facets on it. It was an egg-shaped stone. And he was quite proud of how beautiful it came out. So when he was in Hong Kong, the Chinese love emeralds, by the way. That's one of the biggest markets for emeralds in the world. He was selling some other emeralds, and the buyer came around to that one stone that weighed 35 carats, the egg-shaped stone that he faceted. And when the buyer said, "How much is this stone?" Mr. Romero said in bad English, he said, "Well, it's $1,000. And the man tried to get him down to $700, to $800. But Mr. Romero, he knew how much work he put into faceting that stone. He said, "No, $1,000 is a good price for that." And so the Chinese man went to the back room and came out with a check for $35,000 because as a professional gem buyer, he was looking at a faceted stone. He was thinking $1,000 per carat. The stone weighs 35 carats. But Mr. Romero, besides being a very simple, humble Colombian man, his daughter still works in the emerald business, he was able to keep a poker face, and he made it outside of the office with his $35,000 check.
Wow.
$34,200 of which was profit.
How was he able to buy a 35-carat, even rough, emerald for only $750 in the first place?
Well, this was the late 80s, and the market was kind of open and new, and the Chinese were thrilled at the steadily rising amount of emeralds that were coming out and going to China. So there was a lot of things going. And the beautiful thing about color stones is that there's no fixed price. There's no price list. It's not like diamonds where you can go on the internet and look up the color and then the clarity and then match it up to the price list. Any colored stone, a ruby, sapphire, or emerald, is only worth what the buyer and seller agree on. There's no list, so it's like selling little works of art, little sculptures. So there is no price. That's why your people skills in the colored stone world are usually better.
It's kind of like antiques. It's only worth what somebody's willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
So, Ron, is a deeper color always better?
Yes, the way you said it is true. The deeper color is better. The darker the stone is not necessarily better, however. If the tone is too dark, the stone tends to look too gray or black, and then it's just not as valuable. It becomes like those dark blue sapphires from Australia. So if you're looking at high saturation of color, yes, that's what causes the price to go up and up.
Ah.
And clarity is secondary in emeralds, and as long as the clarity of the stone does not detract from the overall beauty of the stone, the price is pretty much based on the color.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ron Ringsrud, the author of Emeralds, A Passionate Guide, The Emeralds, The People, Their Secrets.
I'm curious about this stone that was carved.
Chapter 13.
It's just unbelievable.
Is carving emeralds something that is commonly done?
Well, the Eastern cultures tend to carve emeralds a lot. The Hindus and the Persians carved emeralds. There's a stone pictured on the first page of chapter 13.
Yeah.
That emerald is over 200 carats, and it's carved with Persian characters, and it's called the Mughal Emerald from the Mughal dynasty. And it is now in the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha, Qatar. The stone has fabulous color, great transparency, and it's priceless, and it's a treasure that it actually belongs in that museum in Qatar because
yes, it does.
The stone was cut there in the East.
Yeah, it is. How does someone go about carving on an emerald?
The artisans from even before medieval times were very skilled at carving and fashioning gemstones. The same artists from the Mughal dynasty, they faceted diamonds, and they carved diamonds as well, which is extremely hard to do. You can only carve a diamond with diamond dust. And so I'm not a lapidary myself, so I can't tell you exactly how they did it, but they did it with a lot of patience and skill.
Well, Ron, would you like to read a section from your book for our listeners today?
I chose a section that is in the geology chapter, and it talks about the intelligence that's inherent inside the gemstones. This is, after all, a passionate guide to emeralds, and another one of the underlying themes of the book is that even though gemology gives us the ability to determine a lot of the physical factors of the gemstone, the chemistry, the specific gravity, the refractive index, it's actually when your intellect surrenders to the gem and lets go, that's when you truly let go into the beauty, the timelessness, the allure, and the charm of that gemstone. And all of those things are immeasurable. They're not quantifiable, and they represent what we call passion. The gemstone itself has the ability to teach you to admire the stone, go ahead and go through your intellectual checklist of, how much it weighs, where it's from, the symmetry of opacity. But after a few minutes of that, your intellect just runs out of things to look at, and suddenly you find yourself falling into the beauty of the stone, the timelessness, the allure. And that's what colored gemstones have in abundance. And a connoisseur of gemstones knows how to do that. In fact, when you hand a gemstone to a connoisseur, you'll see after a minute with the stone, you'll see his shoulders will drop, his face will brighten, and these are the physiological corresponding factors that accompany the mental letting go and falling into the utter primal elemental beauty that a gemstone has to offer with its color, its allure, its clarity. So going even deeper into a gemstone, in my research, I found a wonderful quote from a professional scientist of gemstones, Dr. Kurt Nassau, and he's talking about the crystal growth process of any crystal, including emeralds. So I'll read a few paragraphs here. Very interesting. The term crystal habit refers to the crystal's unique shape, size, and appearance. Crystal habits are useful in communicating how a particular mineral should look. At the Fellow of Gemological Association in Great Britain, the students speak with wide-eyed amazement about the amount of crystallography they have to learn. The intricacies of crystal growth are mysterious, and studying them reveals more secrets of nature. The hammer, tongs, and anvil of emerald formation are heat, pressure, and chemical reactions. But there's a delicacy to the formation as well. The remarkable delicacy of crystal growth, worthy of its own book, is summarized here. A crystal is a solid body with a characteristic internal structure. In that structure, the atoms are arranged in an orderly, geometrically repeating pattern. Glass, however, is simply an agglomeration of atoms with no structure or pattern. Glass is amorphous. A crystal, however, is a special formation. Its geometrically arranged atoms create flat plane surfaces that intersect at characteristic angles that correspond to the crystal habit of that gemstone. The shape of the crystal, square, pyramidal, hexagonal, displays the stacking of the unit cells that make up that mineral. The crystal structure is like a motif. It's a set of atoms arranged in a particular manner. The hexagonal shape found in every emerald crystal means that its basic molecule-sized building block is hexagonal. So it is due to the law of nature called affinity that in the heated depths of the geologic fluid melts, atoms of similar makeups magically detect each other's presence and begin to move toward each other. Similar affinities among different atoms create unit cells. They don't just clump together, but they align in perfect order, one upon the other, in geometrical stacking. As the crystals grow to visible size, their form reveals flat planes. Be careful in your visualization of this process. It's not a mechanical, systematic stacking of building blocks. Gem scientist and crystal grower Kurt Nassau observed crystal growth and found that it is really quite the opposite. Crystal growth is more like a lively and intelligent group enterprise. Mm-hmm. And here is the quote from Dr. Nassau. The speed and precision of the crystal growth under the earth, millions of years ago, in the geologic origins, depends on many factors, including temperature, concentration, purity of the solution. Assuming an ideal solution, each additional atom to be added from the solution must first find a location on the growing surface of the developing crystal. Thus, these atoms in solution are randomly moving about, making random collisions with the crystal at random locations on the surface. How can they build a perfect single crystal? Their little secret is that some atoms that have been added at marginal locations, say, can escape from these surface locations to allow other atoms from other solutions to find a better location nearby. Better here meaning that better to be held electrostatically tighter to the crystal. But these better locations do not occur in chronological order because they're determined by the collective influence of numerous atoms already in the crystal. And for the best position 1 microsecond ago may not be the best position for an atom now. Therefore, the addition and subtraction of atoms from the growing crystal surface proceeds almost by trial and error. Consequently, one cannot write down an algorithm for placing atoms from the solution to a growing crystal. It really is like an intelligent group exercise, the growth of a crystal. Then my commentary after that quote is, a sense of wonder comes with contemplating how, in the turmoil of geologic exertion, such a delicate ordering can take place. Once this is accomplished, it takes millions of years for geologic forces to push the material up to the surface where it can be found by humans. During those millions of years, most gems get crushed into small pieces of dust. Crystals surely are the rare flowers of geology. So from that quote, you can see how at the deepest levels of nature, there really is intelligence at work doing everything, including looking over the growth of a crystal and making sure that the stacking of the atoms and molecules is precise.
And you,
I thought you our listeners would like that a lot, about the intelligence inherent in nature.
And it makes me wonder what the underlying purpose of it is. You know, why would nature go to so much trouble to make these beautiful, beautiful gems?
You know, another thing I found in my research was that we already know from the Vedas that the three most powerful transformative things in the life of a human being are mantras, herbs, and gems. In my research, I was studying the medieval lapidaries, and the word lapidary here is used as books written about stones, written by the medievals. In fact, my chapter 23 is all about the medieval last days. And it was interesting to find out that the medievals also felt that they recognized the use of what they said, words, gems, and plants. So they basically had the same idea that the Vedas had for what are the most powerful things in the human world. The quote is, God has given virtues to stones, to words, and to herbs. Mm. So in the concluding chapter of my book, I talk about the presence of gems on our planet. It's just a gift from God. It's something for us to enjoy like flowers.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, you also talk about the relationship between gemstones and astrology. Of course, I think everyone, I mean, as a child, I remember every month, every birth month had its own stone. But I did not know until I read your book that maybe those birth stones are not what they ought to have been. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. In the gem world, we all know about the birthstone charts that were created in 1916 by an association of jewelers in the United States, and some of the gemstones were just randomly put in rather than put in the birthstone chart for any specific reason. So that's why Western astrology has been limited by some of its ability to be predictive and useful in the world. If you go back to Vedic astrology or Jyotish, the material in the stones is what is selected for its transformative properties and the ability to mitigate the effects of a certain planet in your astrological chart. So this is just another beautiful example of making the most use of the planetary influence through a gemstone. Right after the Jyotish chapter in the book is a chapter called Using Poetry to Reflect the Aesthetic Experience of a Gemstone. And this is another result of looking into the passion part of emeralds, because there have been some poems written by Pablo Neruda about emeralds. And the poetry of emeralds is significant. It's worthy of its own chapter. In fact, the chapter ends talking about how in another place, in another time, it might be that it would be the scientific chapter that gets stuck in the end of a book rather than the poetry chapter.
Ah, so the poetry might take precedence over the science.
Yes, it's true.
There's
a lady in a Bay Area poet, Susan Griffin. She felt that in modern society, the status of poets does not need to be inferior to the status of science. Mm. Poetic metaphors, this is an important way of seeing things as scientific metaphors. So we have to give that some attention, and the poetry chapter goes into that. It's very, very interesting, and since the book has been out for over a year now, I've gotten some beautiful feedback from people thanking me for putting that chapter in there.
Now, Ron, before we leave the topic of gemstones and astrology, when I was I have a December birthday, and I always thought that the emerald was the true birthstone for December. Is that not true? I mean, I was always kind of attached to emeralds.
You don't know. I'm not a Jyotish astrologer, but once you know your rising sign, then you can determine what would be your birthstone. Mm. And for the different months, I'm not sure what those would be in the light of modern understanding of Vedic astrology.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ron Ringsrud, author of Emeralds, A Passionate Guide, The Emeralds, The People, Their Secrets. And Ron was introduced to us by a friend of mine, Dennis Kossow, here in Fairfield, and I understand Dennis makes an appearance in your book.
Yes, he does, Monica. And he also showed up in the geology chapter, because in the year 1993, Dennis and I came to Colombia to go out to the Emerald Mines. We were invited by a mine investor named Miller, and Mr. Miller took some very seasoned geologists out along with Denny and myself. And we had a little adventure out there. We got wet and dirty in the mine, got muddy climbing up hills looking for outcrops of shale, which might yield some information about where to find emeralds. And it was quite interesting. Denny is not a trained mineralogist or geologist, but he's very useful to the group because he has an affinity for gems. He's a natural stone person.
He had a strong affinity with the earth.
As the photo in the book of him shows. What exactly is Dennis doing in this photograph?
Well, I asked Denny, and he explained to me that the photograph was taken in Utah somewhere, and they were looking for quartz specimens or feldspar, and all you can see in the photograph is the side of a rock face, and Denny's legs are sticking out.
Yeah.
So that's about as far as his fame in the book goes. You can see his legs. And the rest of him is swallowed up by the cave that he's in looking for minerals. So that's about the best example of an affinity with the earth that I can think of.
Now, one of the delights of this book is the stories, your own personal anecdotes and stories of your own personal experiences buying emeralds, and also of other people, that are sprinkled throughout the book, both modern and historical. So there's in this same chapter, or the buying and cutting rough emeralds, you have a story about the one that got away. Do you want to share that with us?
Yes, that's a quick story to share, but another good one for people that buy the book is one in the buying chapter, chapter 10, I believe. It's called Bad Tweezer Etiquette Can Be Life-Threatening.
Ooh.
It's a long story. You'll just have to read it in the book.
Yeah, we only have about 4 minutes left, so we'll have to stick with the short one.
Right. Well, the one that got away was just an example of how gems really talk to you. And this was in the late 1980s at the Cosquez Emerald Mine, which was just the buildup before the Emerald Wars. And so the whole area was tense, and you had to pretty much ask permission to get out of the Jeep when you go to this one area. And we looked at some stones and didn't like anything, and Mr. Escobar that I was with, he passed the stone over to me. And I thought it was interesting, but it only happened when I was handing the stone back to the man that was offering it for sale, that the stone captured the light in a certain angle, and the stone suddenly said to me, "I'm beautiful, buy me." And another underlying theme of the chapter is that if you snooze, you lose. Sometimes you only have 10 seconds or 30 seconds to make a decision or to go for something, and then the opportunity's gone. And this was one of those things. For me to ask for the stone back would cause him to raise the price. I hesitated, and funnily enough, 20 years later, when I was writing the book, I remembered that same stone that I never bought, and I regret it still, because it showed an internal reflection that would have yielded maybe a 2-carat stone and would have been very beautiful, and we'll never know because I snoozed, I lost it, it got away. So that's a good story for anybody to learn from other people's mistakes in the gem world.
Well, Ron, in our last couple minutes, first of all, where can people find your book?
The book is available at gem shows throughout the United States, but it's not available on Amazon. It's not at your regular bookstores. It is a gem book, so you can buy it most easily at emeraldpassion.com. That's www.emeraldpassion.com. It's also, you can link through that from my own website, my business website, which is www.emeraldmine.com. And in about 18 more months or 1 year, the book will be available through Amazon and other places. But right now, the book is too new to go to those other sources.
And when you were deciding to self-publish it, did you consider trying to find a mainstream publishing house to do all that for you instead?
Well, people that knew more than I did about publishing, they told me that a publisher would have good sales for you for the first year, but then you'd be pretty much abandoned. And whereas when you self-publish, you can continue to sell year after year. And the book is a worthy book, and it'll be valuable and useful year after year. So I listened to some people in the gem industry, like Richard Wise and John Cuevala, who have published successful books about gems. And so I did. I took a mortgage out on my house to get $60,000 to print myself.
Wow.
And we've sold enough books in the first year to cover all of my production expenses.
Great.
So I've learned a new business.
Wow.
And had a lot of fun doing it. I encourage anybody else to take their passion and write about it and go for it.
Of course, the thing is, you know what you're talking about in this book. You know.
And that makes all the difference.
That makes
the
all
world.
The difference, yes.
That's, well, thank you so much for joining us today on Writer's Voices, Ron, all the way from Bogota, Colombia.
Oh, gosh, what a thrill.
Wow.
And yes, I see some dark clouds coming in. I'm on the 12th floor here. It might rain later on. So thanks for inviting me, and hello to all my friends in Fairfield, and I thank you again for the invitation.
And when next time you're here, I'd love to see some emeralds.
Yes.
It'll be my pleasure.
And that was Writer's Voices with Ron Ringsrud, Emeralds, A Passionate Guide, The Emeralds, The People, Their Secrets, available at www.emeraldpassion.com. And do you have a quote for us to close with
I
today?
I do. This comes from Thomas Jefferson, who said a long time ago, "In matters of style, swim with the current. In matters of principle, stand like a rock."
Stay tuned now on Friday for Planet Earth's Wild. If you're listening Monday morning, I'm not quite sure what's coming up next, but James Moore, I'm sure, will have many delightful things to share with you in the next 3 hours on KRUU. See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.